Okay, ready to get started? Okay, so today we want to do a couple things, three things. We want to first briefly show you what this pattern recognition app that we have is capable of. Then we want to talk about error bounds, and then we'll talk a little bit about discrete features and that kind of thing, how we do classification with discrete features. So, if you remember last time, we had talked about how to classify data, multivariate Gaussian data, using maximum a posteriori classification, Bayes' rule, essentially. And we talked about, here were some two class examples, and we showed the corresponding decision surfaces. I'll work from the terminal here for a moment. So we have, over the years, been developing an applet, and you've got a link to this in the notes, where you can go in and create pattern recognition data sets and then classify them. And the applet's fairly easy to use, and we have some pre-stored cases arranged. So let me just go ahead and show you how this works. We're going to select a two Gaussian case, and when we do that, it goes ahead and creates data. Let me do all that. Let me do it again. Okay. So in this case, we've generated two Gaussian distributions, and you can go in and edit the parameters of these distributions and such. I won't go through all that today. And then you can go ahead and select an algorithm. And this applet has in it a number of the algorithms that we'll talk about this semester. What I'll do today, just to show you quickly how this works, is to choose the class-independent PCA analysis. Now, what that means, that's the case where we're going to assume each class has equal variance. And the variance in this case is we'll go ahead and actually compute a transformation based on the global variance of the data. So we can go ahead and step through this and see how this works. We're going to initialize the applet. Then we're going to just sort of step through it. We're going to display the original data in the lower panel. We're going to then essentially compute the covariance of the data, because we're going to need to do that to do the whitening transformation. And in this case, since it's class-independent data, it's going to take all of this data as essentially the class, and it's going to compute the covariance of that data. Well, the covariance of this data looks like it has a lot of variation in this direction and very little variation in this direction. So now that it's done that, it's going to go ahead and find the decision surface. And in this case, if you remember from last class, since we have this variance in this direction, the optimal decision surface is going to be in this direction. Now, this is actually doing maximum likelihood. It's not taking into account the prior probabilities of these distributions. But it draws this decision surface because that's essentially halfway between the two classes. And since we're doing class independent, the variances of each class are the same, and the priors are the same, essentially. So the terms that would shift this boundary in the direction of one of the classes essentially go to zero, because if you remember, they were the log of the ratios of these things. So this is probably the simplest case. It essentially finds a boundary which is halfway between the means of these classes. Now we can repeat this analysis for class-dependent. Now, in this case, it's going to try to find the covariances for each one of the classes separately. So here we will redraw the data. Now we're going to find the covariances of the data, and you'll notice now that it's taken each class separately. It's a little hard to see with the colors. But it's essentially modeled the covariance of each class. So this is the case where we have unequal covariances, and it's going to apply a decision surface that takes into account the variances of the two classes. And then it's going to find a decision surface. So in this case, the decision surface is a little bit shifted because now it's actually using the covariances of each class. So you get a little, you don't quite get a straight line due to the numerical issues with the classes. We don't have perfect variances here, but you get an idea of what the decision surface looks like. Now, we can sort of better illustrate this. And one of the things I'd like you to do after class today is to go and play with some of these cases. So here we have a slightly more interesting case. We have two classes where the variance is in this direction, but what we call the discrimination is in this direction. In other words, to differentiate between these classes, you don't really look in this direction. You can actually look in that direction, but the direction of discrimination is more in this direction. And you can run that kind of a class, and you can get and see what results. And then you can work on successively harder situations. Here's another interesting case, because the variance for this class is in this direction, the variance for this class is in this direction. The discrimination between these two classes is in this direction. And we'll spend time this semester talking about why certain algorithms fail on these classes. An extreme case that we'll talk about later in the semester that we'll need more powerful algorithms for are cases like this, where one class is actually enclosed by the other, and my personal favorite is this, the yin-yang. So here, you're going to need some kind of curved or piecewise linear type of decision surface for this. You can't simply separate these classes with a line. What's nice about this tool is that you can also just go ahead and draw points. And then you can go ahead and classify them. So you see the class-independent PCA, all it can really do is draw a line between the classes. So it's going to try to draw a line somewhere on a perpendicular to a line that connects the means of the classes. And that's about the best it can do. With some of the other classifiers, we can draw surfaces that will better classify this kind of data. So this is a tool that we'll use to demonstrate how you classify particular difficult data sets. We have several algorithms loaded into this, including support vector machines and some discriminant analysis techniques that we'll talk about later in the semester. We also have some clustering algorithms loaded and some simple nearest neighbor classifiers loaded. And then there are other tools like this on the internet. We developed this quite a while ago, but you should find it useful in understanding concepts. The goal would be when you draw a set of classes, you could predict ahead of time what the decision surface should be, and then you go ahead and run the applet and see if it matches what you thought. And if it doesn't, then you need to understand that. You need to think about what went wrong. Because I can tell you that finding these decision surfaces is not always trivial. They sometimes are, you know, you look at the data, you think they should go one way, but then you realize the applet actually did the right thing. But it takes a little bit of understanding to do that, an analysis to understand that. Okay, so that's one tool we have at our disposal. A second tool that I want to talk briefly about today are error bounds. Error bounds are important because very often the complete analytical solution to a problem is intractable. And bounds and things like error bounds
give us a way of deriving classifiers when the actual functions that we're trying to analyze are too difficult. So we'll see how that works in a moment. So Bayes' decision rule guarantees the lowest average error rate. We have closed form solution for two class Gaussian distributions. That's a very nice, very elegant derivation. However, for most real problems, the equations of these boundaries and the calculations of the Bayesian error rates and these kinds of things are very complicated. So full calculation for high dimensional spaces or for multiple classes or such is difficult. Bounds provide a way to get insight into a problem and a way to engineer better solutions. If you have any exposure to communication theory, for example, over the years, many different kinds of error correction and detection codes have been developed. And all of these were developed using bounds on error rates because you need a relatively smooth bound to be able to derive some code that sort of optimizes with respect to that bound. So when you're trying to build classification algorithms and trying to prove, as graduate students, trying to prove that your algorithm is theoretically better than a previous algorithm, you're going to typically work with bounds on the error rate, not the actual error rate, because you need some kind of simpler function to deal with. Now, to proceed with the two bounds I'm going to talk about today, we need to make use of an inequality that's used frequently in this kind of work, and that says that the minimum of A and B is less than or equal A to the beta times B to the 1 minus beta for A and B greater than or equal to 0 and beta between 0 and 1. And we'll use this in the context of probabilities, so sort of hold on to this. This actually is well known and comes from information theory. Assume A is greater than or equal to B without loss of generality, and therefore the minimum of A and B is going to be B. Also, we can write that A to the beta times B to the 1 minus beta is equal to A over B to the beta times B just by rearranging terms, and therefore A over B raised to the beta is greater than or equal to 1 because A is greater than B. And and beta is between 0 and 1. So therefore, B is less than or equal to A over B to the beta times B, which implies that the minimum of A and B is less than or equal A to the beta times B to the 1 minus beta. So it's just a brief demonstration or proof that this theorem holds. Let's just hold this for a moment and we'll see how we apply this to our standard expression for the probability of error. So first let's derive what's called the Chernoff bound, and then we're going to derive another bound that's slightly looser called the Batcheria bound. So the probability of error, if you recall, was the integral of the minimum of these posteriors, p of omega 1 given x and p of omega 2 given x times p of x dx. This is analytically how we compute the probability of error. Now you can see the problem with this is that we have to integrate a minimum function, which could be complicated if these posteriors are overlap and are not simple functions. So we can write this as the integral of the minimum of, we can use Bayes' rule and write these as p of omega 1, the prior on omega 1, times the likelihood p of x given omega 1 over p of x. And then similarly for the second term, we can write the prior times the likelihood divided by the evidence. We can have that minimum times p of x, dx. Now we can, in turn, we can look at this expression and we can note that we can basically let these p of x's cancel because these p of x is a positive going function. So with respect to the minimization, we can essentially cancel these. Can't do that in general, but we can do that because p of x is always greater than or equal to 0. It's a probability. So this becomes the minimum of these two terms, the prior times the likelihood, prior times the likelihood. And so this is all sort of straightforward. Now we want to go ahead and apply our inequality. This minimization, minimum of A and B here, where A is equal to this term, B is equal to this term, we're going to write this as this term raised to the beta power times this term raised to the 1 minus beta dx. And we're going to say that the probability of error is less than or equal to this. Now, that's essentially what makes it a bound. We're taking the exact expression and we're bounding it by something which we hope is pretty close. And this in turn can then be written as we have the integral is with respect to x. So anything that's not a function of x we can pull out. So we can pull out this probability of omega 1, the prior raised to the beta power, the probability of omega 2 to the 1 minus beta power. And now we just have the integral of the likelihood raised to the beta power times the likelihood with respect to class omega 1 times the likelihood with respect to class omega 2 to the 1 minus beta dx. Now note that this integral is over the entire feature space, not the decision regions, which makes it simpler. If it was over the decision regions, then we'd have a problem integrating along the, you'd have to do like a line integral or a surface integral or some really complicated thing. But what's nice about this integral is it's over the feature space, and it involves the likelihood of the feature given the class, which is something we can measure. And in the case where these are Gaussians, like our multi-class Gaussian problem, this actually can be simplified even further, but I don't really want to go into that today. The main thing I wanted to do is just introduce this as a bound on the probability of error, which has a much simpler, much more tractable structure. Now you can then, for example, let's say you're trying to minimize the probability of error. Well, you can go ahead and try to build a classifier that minimizes this expression, and that's essentially what people have done. And when you do that, you will get a classifier which won't be perfect. There's going to be some difference between the bound and the actual probability of error, but hopefully it will be fairly close. I don't have the right thing back in that thing. So if the conditional probabilities are normal, this integral can be evaluated analytically, because we're just going to have essentially two multivariate Gaussian distributions here. And we're actually going to see that a lot this semester, the product of multiple Gaussian distributions. And there's a whole area of science that deals with that kind of issue. And we're going to see that shortly when we talk about things like non-informative priors and such. But for the moment, we can note that this integral can be written as the e to the minus this function k of beta, where k of beta is this rather sort of complicated looking thing. And I won't derive this, but it just will point out that you see in here some things that we're used to seeing. You see that this quadratic form, where you have a vector transpose times an inverse matrix times a vector transpose. And the quadratic involves the differences between the means, which would make sense in this case because we're looking at the probability of error, which is a trade-off between, we're trying to assign the data to one of two classes, and that's going to depend really on where the means are relative to one another. But it will also be scaled by the covariances. So we have this term here, which represents a mixing, if you will, of the covariances of the two data. And then we have a constant term that's again related to the determinants of this mixed covariance matrix and the covariances individually. So this is a rather reasonable looking expression for the case where your Gaussian, you have Gaussian distributions for your data. And this is what's known as the Chernoff bound for normal densities. And remember, it's a bound, so this is not the exact probability of error, but the true probability of error will always be less than or equal to the probability of error generated from this bound. So one of the ways this is applied is to find the value of beta that minimizes this term and then compute the probability of error associated with that, and that probability of error will be larger than the true probability of error, but hopefully that probability of error will be fairly close. So here is this function plotted, and this is the point at which beta is minimum, and that is the point that, and then that value of beta is used to give you the probability of error. The details of this example are in the book, but it just demonstrates how you apply this. So if I give you two Gaussians, if you know the means and covariances of the two classes, you can write this formula, you can then find the minimum value of beta numerically, and then you can compute the probability of error, and you can do a bound for that, yeah?
How does this scale up for more than two classes?
Well, that's a problem. Once you get into multiple classes or you get into non-Gaussian data, things get a little bit messy. And I don't know the extent to which this has been applied to multiple classes. My guess is that would get pretty messy, because when you have multiple classes, the decision surface is no longer aligned. It becomes either a sequence of lines or a curve. So, but a lot of times, what you'll do is you'll use two classes to understand the problem, and we'll see that later when we talk about, for example, principal components analysis versus linear discriminant analysis versus SVM versus LDA. We'll compare all these. Well, we can talk about two-dimensional cases, two-class two-dimensional cases, and really demonstrate what's different about each one of these algorithms. And then we can allude to the multi-dimensional cases for these, which involve some linear algebra. But it becomes harder to visualize or to be very specific about that. So another benefit of this approach is that the process of finding the probability of error becomes a one-dimensional search rather than a two-dimensional search, which we had for the original data. So it is a little bit simpler to apply this. So a lot of these things were developed in the 1960s when we were at the very beginning of computing, and people really needed analytical methods to understand and apply some of the theory that had been developed. Today, you won't see as much of this kind of work, but I like to point this out just for historical reasons. You'll also run into the Chernoff bound in communication theory if you go on to take any kind of classes in coding theory and things like that. Once people developed the Chernoff bound, they analyzed its behavior, and they showed that while its performance in sort of the mid-range was good, the bound was rather loose for extreme values. So an alternate bound was developed called the Vaticaria bound, and that's simply a sort of a special case of the Chernoff bound where we set beta equal to 0.5. So if you, before we had this expression where we had the probability was bounded by the priors raised to the beta and the 1 minus beta power times this integral, and if we set beta equal to 1/2, then we have essentially the square root of the product of the priors times the integral of the square root of the product of the likelihoods. And that can also be written for the Gaussian case as e to the minus k of beta, where k of beta is this function that looks something like this. We have now, instead of the beta and 1 minus beta, we essentially have the average of the covariances for these scale terms, and we still have the differences in the means. So this is an alternate bound on the probability of error. Now, one of the things that you'll notice is that these bounds, the first thing you might say is, well, what if my data is not Gaussian? And in the non-Gaussian case, we don't get as clean, we probably don't get any kind of closed form solution like this. But people actually do apply these bounds to non-Gaussian data. And the reasons for that sort of relate to principle of Occam's razor that we've alluded to a few times. The bounds may not be adequately tight if the data is not Gaussian, but you will see people apply these bounds and try to prove properties of their classifiers in terms of these bounds, even when the data is non-Gaussian. Okay, so that's a little bit on error bounds. We won't spend too much time this semester on these things, because in today's world, we typically investigate the properties of our classifiers using experimental methodologies. And I think it's, for most of you, you'll spend time looking at things on an experimental basis rather than a theoretical basis. But when you get to a point where you're trying to create a new algorithm and understand its properties, then you may have a need to use the bounds. Now, the second thing that I want to talk about, which is sort of related to this notion of bounding of the error rates, is how do we compare two decision rules if they require different thresholds for optimum performance? So, for example, you have one problem. We talked about at the beginning of the semester this problem of sorting fish between salmon and sea bass. And then you have another problem, let's say speech recognition. You're trying to recognize someone speaking one of two words, yes or no, for example, build a yes no recognizer. And you demonstrate that your new algorithm works better than algorithm A works better than algorithm B on the sea bass problem, but algorithm A works worse than algorithm B on the speech recognition problem. Now, your first temptation might be to conclude that algorithm A is no good. But as you dig more deeply into this problem, you may find that these two algorithms are operating at different parameter settings on these different data sets. And therefore, it's not really fair to directly compare them, because one is biased more differently than the other. Algorithm A on the first set may have a very high rejection rate. On the second set, it may have a very high substitution rate. It may not be performing the same way on both systems. So it's never really fair to compare algorithms for a single operating point. And this is, I think, one of the points that I really want to drive home this semester. And I know this is one of the points I want to drive home, but it's a very, very common problem. In your work, you will be tempted to produce the table that says, algorithm A, algorithm B, algorithm C, and you'll just have these numbers. But in reality, each one of those algorithms probably has a different operating point which achieves the minimum error rate. And it's not really fair to compare one algorithm to another algorithm when they're operating at different operating points. Instead, what we really want to do is to compare their performance over a whole range of operating conditions. And we want to show that one algorithm is always better than the other algorithm. So let me sort of explain how that works. We have essentially four types of errors that can be made in a if we think about a two-class classification problem, class one, class two, it is possible that when you recognize X, X was in fact a member of omega 2. So I give you a data point X, you assign it to class number 2, and in fact that was the right assignment because your classifier said the probability that X belongs to class 2 was the highest, and in fact X did belong to class 2. Okay, so that's a good thing, right? The data one, you got the data correct. So we're going to call that a hit. That's also sometimes called a correct recognition. Now, what happens, what is a miss? Well, we have a miss if you assign that element to class 1 because your probability measure said it really belongs to class 1, but in fact that data point belonged to class 2. Okay, so you assign the data point to the wrong class. We call that a miss. Sometimes that's also called a substitution error because you substituted the wrong class assignment. But those aren't the only two types of errors that you can make. Those are the only two types of errors you can make if you do what's called a forced choice scenario, where for every data point you have to make a decision. You're forced to make a decision on every data point. But as we've talked about a little bit this semester, in real world problems, you also have alternatives to reject the data. We talked about that in the case of a voice response system. You call up, it asks you to say one of these four words, you speak the word, it's not really sure what you said, so it chooses to bounce you to the operator rather than assign you to the wrong class. Another example at the sort of extreme end of the continuum is you're sitting on the button. This, since we just had an inauguration, this is one of Obama's wonderful jobs. What does he carry around with him? The key, the little briefcase, right? And what happens when he turns the key and looks at that little red button? If he punches that red button, basically say goodbye to the world, right? Because that sets off our entire nuclear arsenal. So, you don't want to punch that button unless you're really, 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 really sure. Now, how do they, the button, thank God, has never been pressed incorrectly, but how do they prevent that? Well, they have enormous numbers of fail-safe mechanisms so that they're always rejecting, essentially, any incident. Something will only, no president's ever had to press the button because they have so many fail-safe measures that they make sure there's a very high, very low error rate. So they'll very often have incidents which will maybe generate one or two or three levels of concern, but thank God it's never reached the president where the president's had to make that decision. So that's a problem where you bias the system. You don't really care about whether it was, you know, the Russians or the Iranians or whoever was going to shoot that missile. You just want to make sure that when you press that button, the button needs to be pressed. So that's a system which is biased much differently than a phone system where if they route one out of every 10 callers to the wrong choice, the world doesn't come to an end. So another alternative we have is what's called a correct rejection. If your algorithm said that you'll get some data point which was associated with, so in a lot of pattern recognition systems, there's always the chance of what's called the null hypothesis. You'll be given a file containing data, or you'll be given, let's say, you'll be looking at a segment of a signal. One choice you'll always be faced with is maybe there was nothing there, but my algorithm is telling me there was something there. So if there was nothing there, and you chose to say there was nothing there, that's what's called a correct rejection. You correctly rejected the hypothesis. If, on the other hand, there wasn't something there and you thought there was something there and you output a hypothesis, it belongs to class one, that's what's called a false alarm. So in real pattern recognition problems, your algorithm essentially has to trade off these four types of errors. And that's typically done through what's called a receive their operating characteristic, where we essentially have probabilities of hits and misses plotted against probabilities of false alarms and rejections. Because these two, essentially, the sum of these two has to be equal to one in terms of probability to sum of these two. So we can plot these on separate axes, and we can in fact look at how an algorithm varies as a function of, for example, rejection threshold. And we can plot the algorithm's performance across the whole range. And then what we hope to be able to say is that algorithm A is in fact better than algorithm B, because across the entire range it's better performance. Now, very often what may happen is that one algorithm will kind of be interlaced with another algorithm, and you may have just been so lucky to pick an operating point where you were better than the other algorithm. But when you look across this whole range, you'll find out typically that your algorithm is really good at, let's say, making very low rejection errors, but it's not so good at making very low hit or miss errors. So this is what's called a receiver operating characteristic. The term comes from communication theory, where this was developed many years ago. And it essentially asks the question, if we look at this in the context of a two-class classification problem, it's not just setting one decision surface, it's actually saying, let's vary the threshold of this decision surface across the whole range, and let's plot these errors. And then that performance across all values of this threshold essentially becomes the performance of my algorithm. And very often then, from an application point of view, you will take these curves and you'll sit down with your customer and you will say, well, tell me how important is it that we reject versus substitute? And you'll sort of decide to operate the system at a certain level by explaining the implications of this to your customer. And your customer may say, well, a false alarm rate of, maybe a good example of this is, if you've had a chance to play around with keyword searching with Google, keyword searching of voice now, which is available, when you type a search term in these kinds of technologies, the false alarm rate is very high. You'll get back about half your documents will not contain the word you were searching for, because that system tends to be biased in a way that there's a very high false alarm rate. Now, you could use a more sophisticated speech recognition algorithm that would have a much lower false alarm rate, an order of magnitude lower false alarm rate, but that algorithm would require 100 times more compute power, typically. So with Google Voice Search and with many voice search algorithms, they choose to use very fast algorithms with high false alarm rates versus more accurate algorithms with low false alarm rates. That's another example of how you choose an operating point based on this receiver operating characteristic. So we'll see this come into some, throughout the semester, but it's something to always bear in mind when you're trying to prove one algorithm is better than another. It may just be you're comparing an algorithm operating here to an algorithm operating over here, and that's not really fair because they're biased for two different points. Two algorithms, when you compare them back to back, it'll rarely be the case that both your hit accuracy and your rejection accuracy will be better. Usually you'll find the algorithms trade these off. One algorithm might be better at hits and misses, another algorithm may be better at rejections, and you have to sort of tweak them to get their performance in the right place. So an ROC curve is typically monotonic but not symmetric. Here we have two likelihoods. Here we have an example of two ROC curves associated with there. And one system can be considered superior to another only if its ROC curve lies above the competing system for the operating region of interest. We'll have a chance to put this to practice later in the semester, but just keep that in mind. Very important when most of you who are working on pattern recognition algorithms with a particular data set, you tend to look at only one operating point, and that's not really the right thing to do. Oftentimes, if you want to look at a single operating point, the people responsible for the evaluation of the algorithms, maybe your sponsor or maybe an evaluation organization, will tell you things like, one hit is equivalent to three false alarms. So you're allowed to make three false alarms for every hit, for every miss, essentially. Misses are bad, false alarms are not so bad. Once they establish that kind of a metric, that's actually equivalent to defining a particular line through this space, and then you can actually look at the performance of systems, because now you're essentially creating a relationship between the two axes. So very often people in technology where that's used extensively is in speaker verification, trying to determine the identity of a speaker. And we often talk about what are called equal error rates. Your system is evaluated at the point for which it produces the same numbers of substitution errors or hit misses as it does rejections. And then you can tell all systems are looked at that particular single operating point.
Hello.
What's my for today?
Okay, so let's next spend a couple minutes talking about discrete features. So thus far, we've been talking about continuous valued features. Probabilities have been a continuous function of the vector x. But what about for problems where we have discrete features, meaning we go from probabilities, continuous functions, to a summation? Now, let's be a little bit careful here. What this says is that the likelihood function itself is still a functional form, but now the features themselves have discrete values. And this is very common in real systems because we always use fixed amount of precision to represent features. So you may have 8-bit features, which means the feature can take on a value of, you know, 1 of 2 to the 8th values. And with discrete features, we can do most of what we've discussed, but we have to pay attention to the fact that instead of integrating over the feature space, we have to sum over the feature space. And those are what are called discrete features. Now, Bayes' rule doesn't really change that much, except that we go from these density functions, which are continuous functions of x, to probabilities, and we denote that with capital P's, because these are now functions of the discrete values of x. And this P of x, the evidence now, instead of being the integral over all of x, it's now the sum over the classes of this. In the previous case, it was the sum over the classes, but now we have the probability of the posterior instead of the density. So we have the probability of x given omega j times probability of omega j. So Bayes' rule and that essentially remains the same. We're still going to find the minimum of our risk and that kind of thing. But some of the details of the results will change. For example, with a continuous random variable, the entropy of a continuous random variable, what is the maximum entropy distribution for a continuous random variable? It's a Gaussian, very good. And the value is something like 4 pi sigma e or something like that. For a discrete random variable, what is the maximum entropy distribution? Well, it's a uniform distribution. Any one of the alternatives are equally probable. So it's a uniform distribution with the weight 1 over n, where n is the number of data points. So that's an example of a concept that sort of changes a little bit from continuous to discrete. But nevertheless, the notion that there is a maximum entropy distribution exists in both domains. So we can work with discrete features Oh, I'm not. So we can work with discrete features, much like we can work with continuous value features. And here we show an example for binary variables. So here we have a vector x, which is composed of binary features. And each one of these elements can take on a probability of 1 or 0. And so we can write p sub I as the probability that a particular element of this vector is equal to 1. And 1 minus p sub I then becomes the probability that's equal to 0. And we can then associate p with class 1 and q with class 2. If we assume conditional independence of the features, we can write that this joint probability of x given omega 1 is just the product of these p sub I times x sub I times 1 minus p sub I times raised to the 1 minus x sub I power. So this is essentially just expressing the probability of this vector by counting the numbers of ones and zeros and multiplying probabilities accordingly. And we can do the same thing for x belonging to omega 2. And then the likelihood ratio of these two then becomes a ratio of these two probabilities, which we can write compactly as this product of these ratios. And a discriminant function to choose between these two classes then becomes essentially the, you can take the log of this, and the log of a product is going to be sum of the logs. So we can get a discriminant function which looks very much like what we had for the Gaussian case with continuous random variables. We have a component due to the priors, we have a component due to the likelihoods, and we have here sort of a nice decomposition of this probability. So with this is an example of how we would do classification on a discrete random variable where these features are binary valued. Now this becomes a little bit more complicated if you allow the features to have multiple states, but we won't really talk about that this semester. But so the main point here is that for discrete features, we can still do all the things we're able to do and we've talked about for continuous features. The only thing that really changes are these likelihood probabilities, which are now going to be in terms of the discrete values of x versus the continuous values of x. But mathematically, everything's the same. So you'll see in the literature quite often people jump between continuous random variables and discrete random variables, but the form of the pattern recognition system doesn't change all that much. Okay, so that's really just the point I wanted to make with these couple slides, that we can work with discrete features equally as well as working with continuous features. Okay, so what we'll begin next class then is maximum likelihood parameter estimation. But up until this point now, we've talked about how to do maximum likelihood classification. That's essentially what Chapter 2 deals with, and now we're going to go into Chapter 3 next class. Okay.
So I will see you on Friday.